Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. On the 28th of May 1588, a fleet of 151 Spanish ships set out from Lisbon, bound for England. Its mission was to transport a huge invasion force across the Channel and assist in the overthrow of Elizabeth I. 2 months later, this mighty Spanish armada was sighted off the coast of Cornwall. Elizabeth was to inspire the English sailors with a famous speech in which she declared, "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too." Appalling weather, poor planning, and spirited English resistance defeated the Spaniards. After a brief battle, their battered fleet fled. This tale of religious dispute, shifting political alliance, and naval brilliance has entered into our national folklore, although some historians argue that it changed nothing. With me to discuss the Spanish Armada are Diane Perkis, fellow and tutor at Keble College, Oxford; Mia Rodriguez Salgado, professor in international history at the London School of Economics; and Nicholas Rogers, senior research fellow at All Souls College at the University of Oxford. Diane Perkis, Elizabeth came to the throne in 1558, that's a misprint, yes. How powerful... Sorry, I'll start again. It just shows that it's live, and there we are. How powerful was England at that time? What was its international standing?
Pretty rubbish, really, in comparison with the international standing of Spain. A good indication of this is that Philip was able to raise almost any amount of money he wanted in loans from Europe's bankers, and Elizabeth couldn't so much as raise a plug nickel, because everyone supposed Spain, superpower, England, weedy little country, they're absolutely bound to win in whatever they undertake. And this, I think, kind of tells us that England was, it was on the margins of Europe, it was doing its best, its entrepreneurial best in the New World, but what it was principally doing was robbing the Spanish treasure fleets and treasure ships. It hadn't found any treasure of its own, unlike Spain, who had the wealth of the conquistadors to draw upon, though it was spending it pretty fast in the various wars in which it was engaged. So Spain, world superpower; England, tiny marginal country.
But this is still the same in the 1580s, that England hasn't progressed in any way by then. We know it's progressed in all sorts of other ways, in its language, in its literature, in its laws, and but it hasn't progressed in terms of power.
No, in terms of power, England is still really a minority player, but it's got involved. It's stuck its nose into a bunch of acts in Europe, particularly the Dutch Revolt, the Revolt of the Dutch Provinces, which the Elizabethan government, really with Elizabeth a very reluctant leader in this, was supporting, trying to support the Protestants in Holland against Spain. There was the particular events of the Leicester expedition to the Netherlands in an effort to support that Dutch revolt. That kind of tweaked Spain's tail. And as well, England was also perpetually, really, kind of privateering around the Spanish treasure fleet.
Privateering was a sort of lightly legally cloaked form of piracy.
Yeah, privateering is kind of a well-heeled, posh piracy, really. Drake, in
the
particular,
Queen was... Let's just get it straight. Privateer was supposed to be licensed by the Crown.
Yeah, that's yes, right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Can I just come in? There we are, little off shores of Western Europe, Ireland, towards the ends of the world, whatever, uttermost ends of the... Spain was in South America. It was all over Europe. It was in Italy.
It was a superpower. It was really very, very big. Yeah. So, I mean, if you think of it in modern world terms, you know, Spain really equates with America, massive world dominance, cultural dominance too, linguistic dominance. England, you know, pretty much on a par with, you know, maybe Poland or the Czech Republic, you know, small but interesting.
Religion is massively important then, yeah. And wars were fought in the name of religion, although wars were fought, in my view, always because people wanted to fight wars for power. But religion was used. Now, England in the 1580s is in a very tricky state. We have an Anglican monarch who has somehow... He's got the Catholics and he's got the Puritans. But let's talk about the Catholicism, though.
Yeah. I think Philip himself would have seen this, would have seen the Armada
Philip
and the invasion of England
Spain, yeah.
in terms of a war for human rights. He would have seen himself as fighting for the rights of Catholics, who were, and it's fair to say, in an increasingly underwater position as the 1580s unfolded. And this was because the Elizabethan government started by being very lenient towards Catholics when Elizabeth took the throne. But that was because they thought that Catholics were just going to disappear, were going to kind of die out as time went on, and they didn't. As a result of various kind of intellectual endeavours on the part of English Catholics, what actually happened was some very high-profile conversions, particularly among Oxford intellectuals. The best known of these are Edmund Campion, who was a fellow of St. John's, and Robert Parsons, also an Oxford fellow. Because of their conversion, the government actually became afraid that English Catholics were going from strength to strength rather than disappearing. And thus the laws against Catholics got more and more and more draconian. Not only were they not allowed to practice their religion, but it became a crime even to harbour a priest. And Edmund Campion himself ended up arrested as soon as he landed, very nastily tortured, and hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn.
Yeah, Rodrigo Salgado, let's talk a bit more about Philip II of Spain. One thing that might surprise listeners was that at one time he was King of England.
Absolutely. People tend to forget that. They think it's natural that England and Spain should be in conflict. But this was a very unusual situation that people found themselves in the later part of the 16th century. In fact, England and Spain had been allies for centuries. That doesn't stop them from fighting on occasion. But they were natural allies because they shared a common enemy, and that was France. And that alliance was both political, but it was also commercial. There were very close commercial ties between England and Spain on the one hand, and England and the possessions in the Netherlands, in modern-day Belgium and Holland, which were also ruled by Philip II. So strong commercial ties. And that closeness was manifest in a number of marriages. We tend to forget that Catherine of Aragon married two English princes for the price of one, Arthur and then Henry VIII. And after that, it's their daughter, Mary Tudor, who marries the Prince of Spain, Prince Philip, who becomes King of England from 1554 until Mary's death in 1558. So this man had been a king. He had lived in England. He knew the English. And he had a real affection, at least for English Catholicism, if not always for the English nobility.
As a footnote, while I was reading notes for this programme, he helped to reorganise the British Navy. Is that true?
He did. he did live to rue the day, but he was a very effective monarch wherever he went and whatever part of the world he either inherited or obtained. He organised defence, and he organised. He came to England and found that Henry VIII's great navy had been allowed to essentially rot. Mm-hmm. And he thought this was very sad, and that the real strength of the English was their navy, and so he reorganised it. And some of the ships that he had either built or rebuilt in his period as King of England fought against him at the time of the Armada.
Dine gave us some idea of the stretch of the Spanish power. Can you just amplify it even a little more?
At the time of the Armada, Philip II was king over the whole of the Iberian Peninsula. But he also was the lord of the Netherlands, of the Low Countries. He possessed most of Italy, a lot of the western Mediterranean islands. He had possessions of North Africa and, of course, the ever-growing colonial empires in the Americas, but also in Asia. So he was a global power, a superpower. But with a great power comes great responsibility and very grave problems. So the idea of this David and Goliath, this major power who can raise any amount of money, and this tiny power, I mean, let's be sensible here. Great powers, great problems, and they cannot raise enough money, usually to defend themselves. So this is a power that is in very great problems in terms of finance. There have been two bankruptcies already. He is severely hampered by the distance between his states. So although a great power, he has great problems. We mustn't get this idea that he was capable of just walking in and wiping the map or wiping little powers off the map.
But there is reality and perception. The perception was of this great power. He had several fleets, but the perception was that there was one enormous fleet. He had several armies, but the perception was that these were the best armies in Europe, very well trained. You faced them at your peril. You were bound to be beaten because they were so strong. That was the very strong perception.
Of the best armies, yes. In terms of the navy, he certainly had one of the greatest navies in the Mediterranean, but not necessarily the greatest. And as far as navies outside of the Mediterranean. Now, this was much more in doubt. In fact, the English had grave concerns that Spain might well attack them one day. But until that armada came to the Channel, neither they nor the Dutch really believed that Philip II could get a navy up to the Channel.
Nicholas Roger, why did he decide to send an armada out when he did in the mid-1580s?
There's still some room for disagreement about this, but my interpretation is that it arose from mutual miscalculation, that it's perfectly certain that Queen Elizabeth could never have deliberately intended to provoke a war with Spain. But my reading of the situation is that she, or perhaps even more her advisers, concluded in the early 1580s that Spain had in fact already taken a decision to crush England, that the jaws of a trap were slowly closing on her, and that her only choice was to fight now when she still had some freedom of manoeuvre and when she still had at least one ally, namely the Dutch rebels, or to wait until it was too late. And so she set out to try to mount operations, more or less semi-proxy, distant operations, which were designed to send a signal to Philip II that she was not powerless.
What were they?
In particular, a quasi-royal expedition to the Caribbean under Drake.
The West Indies expedition.
The West Indies expedition. And Philip II, for his part, I think, had not, in fact, decided that it was unavoidable to engage in this appallingly difficult and costly operation until this point, when he came to the conclusion that he was never going to be able to solve all his other foreign policy problems, in particular never going to be able to crush the rebellion in the Low Countries unless he dealt with the English first. And therefore, at this point, I think, committed himself to a war which I believe he hadn't fully decided on before then.
What part did two factors play? One is the religious factor, the perceived persecution of the Catholics. He was a very religious man and he saw himself as the defender of the Catholics. You can talk better about that than I can, of course. And the other was the execution of Mary Queen of Scots in 1587, the year before the Armada. What part did those two things play in his decision?
You can't isolate religion from any matter of international politics in this period. And Philip II is unquestionably a man of real devotion who would have loved to restore England to the Catholic fold. He would have regarded that as justifying being a king, doing a service to God like that. On the other hand, he'd done absolutely nothing for the previous 20 years, apart from make diplomatic overtures to Queen Elizabeth. I gravely doubt if religion alone would ever have driven him to this extraordinarily expensive and risky operation if there had not also, or perhaps primarily, been reasons of state. And, of course, when he had made the decision, the whole business of justifying it to the outside world had to be essentially two-faced. To the Catholic world, he had to say, this was an enterprise to restore the faith, I need your support. But to the Protestant world, there were many Protestant princes whose alliance, or at least whose neutrality, he desperately needed. He had to present it as an operation of state, having nothing to do with religion at all. And in fact, this is essentially what he tried to do, to sing a different song to different audiences.
And succeeded before he set off?
To a limited extent succeeded.
Because he had his fleet blessed. That was a fairly public declaration of where he was, didn't it?
Yes, he had his fleet blessed, and he got a papal blessing. On the other hand, Sixtus V, who was nobody's fool, and who was not in the least keen on aggrandising the Spanish Empire, however much he wanted England returned to the Spanish throne, actually gave strictly limited support on very tight conditions. And this is important because it, in fact, distorted the strategy, at least on my interpretation, it distorted the whole strategy of the Armada, the conditions that Sixtus V imposed.
Can you elaborate a little?
Sixtus V was happy to see England return to the Catholic throne, but wanted to ensure that it was not returned to the Spanish Empire. His condition for providing, amongst other things, an extremely large sum of money, which he promised only on cast-iron evidence that the Spanish army was already ashore and not beforehand.
Ashore on our shore.
Ashore in England.
Yeah.
Was that the enterprise should be commanded by a non-Spanish prince of independent standing. And his choice was the Duke of Parma, who of course is an Italian prince, but is also firstly Philip II's nephew, and secondly his commander-in-chief in the Low Countries. So the papal conditions effectively mean that the landing force cannot be carried in ships from Spain, at least not the primary landing force, that it has to be transported across the channel from what is now Belgium.
Diane Perkis, so what was his plan? He's decided to... Was there a little... We've got a very, very comprehensive view of the background now, and we've been brought right up to speed, as it were. But what was his plan? How did he calculate how many ships, what sort of ships... And so on.
A lot of debate about exactly how many ships even set sail from Spain and how big the fleet was, but estimates sort of suggest something in the region of 130 to 150 ships. How they calculated the basis of the plan, as Nick just said, it, really importantly, was this idea of rendezvousing with Parma in and around the Low Countries.
So they're going to go from Spain, pick up the fighting force in the Netherlands.
Yeah. So that was the big idea.
30,000 of them.
Yeah, and therefore that completely dictated the way they sailed. They had to sail basically right along the south coast of England in order to rendezvous with Parma's army. This was really tricky because actually the commander of the Armada, Medina Sidonia and Parma, didn't have any contact with each other despite sending repeated messages that didn't get through for the entire duration of the Armada's voyage. So Medina Sidonia, commanding the ships, had no way of knowing where Parma's army was, whether it was ready to embark. In fact, Parma's army had been overtaken by illness and the sort of disasters that always happen to early modern armies massively reduced its size from the expectation that Medina Sidonia had. And moreover, they couldn't really find a sensible place to rendezvous because once they were traversing the south coast of England, the English fleet was in hot pursuit and they couldn't get to a deep water harbour safely and securely where they could rendezvous with Parma. So the whole thing was based on a premise that turned out to be completely invalid.
Can we stick with detail? Because it's fascinating, isn't it? Amir Rodriguez Salgado. How long did it take to put the fleet together? What sort of ships did he want for different purposes? He's got to pick up an army of 30,000 people. Mm. He's got to have fighting ships because he knows the British have got, English have got fighting ships. So how did he put it together?
It was a very complex operation. Mm. He had his best soldiers fighting in the Low Countries, and it was going to be a complete waste of time and money to bring them over from there to Spain. But he had his best ships in the Iberian Peninsula. So, one of the problems of this great empire is that its forces are scattered. Mm-hmm. And what he decides to do is to attack England, but for a very long time, the nature of that attack remains open, remains up for grabs, and even the target is undecided. There's a lot of talk, perhaps, of attacking Ireland rather than going against England directly. But in the end, they come to the conclusion that the best thing is to send a large fleet from Spain that will act as a convoy and a defence shield for the army that will be put together in the Low Countries. And people think of the Armada as the main force, but it wasn't. This is an auxiliary force. What the majority of that fleet contains is a very large convoy that is carrying absolutely everything for the army that is in the Low Countries, which is going to be transported in very small boats. And so they're carrying food, they're carrying tents, they're carrying wooden spoons and bowls for the army. It's a huge convoy, and around that convoy there is a relatively small group of, if you like, first frontline vessels of fighting ships that are protecting it. But that's why the Armada is so slow. That's why the Armada has to stay in a very tight formation throughout its voyage, because the majority of those ships are not fighting ships. And in the end, Philip II tries to get as many ships as he can. As with every early modern power, he does not have very many ships of his own. What they do, Elizabeth does the same, when there is a crisis or a war, you simply embargo or impound all the good quality ships that happen to be in your ports, and you make adjustments to them, and then they are incorporated into your navy.
Tight formation, what was the formation?
It was in a sort of half moon, with the majority of the ships in the middle, surrounded by these larger and much better armed ships that both protected them, but also, when necessary, broke off to tackle the English fleet.
Nicholas,
floating testudo, really, in which there was a kind of outer perimeter wall formed by the actual gun warships around the weaker ships in the centre.
Nicholas, can you give us some idea of the comparisons between what the Spanish fleet, we've begun to get an idea of that, what that looked like, and the English fleet, but who were to oppose it?
Well, Queen Elizabeth had, and some of her subjects had as well, a small number of very powerful warships of a new class. The English had specialised in trying to combine two things which were pretty new at sea. The first was carrying very heavy battering guns, and the second was what we call the ship rig, a really effective, powerful, fast sailing rig. And they'd got quite a lot further than the Spaniards had with this. The Spaniards, on the whole, were in the business of open ocean navigation, which they were practically 100 years ahead of the English. Hardly anybody in the English fleet had experience of deep sea navigation. Whereas the Spaniards had been crossing the Atlantic, obviously, ever since the discovery, almost 100 years before. They'd been running big convoys across the Atlantic for 40 years. They were deeply experienced in all this kind of thing. But what they were essentially in the business of was armed convoy escorts, whereas the English were in the business of attacking and had built up this small but impressive force of powerful ships. The Queen's ships, probably the most powerful of all, for defensive purposes, but some of her subjects, of course, with rather smaller but also powerful ships, using them for aggressive and profit-making war, are in the Atlantic.
So can you give us some idea of the numbers involved? On we've got 120 to 150. I chose the larger number in my introduction to the programme. Let's say around that. What did the English have? Because the view is, we still have the Agincourt view of it, don't we, which was very good at school. That we few and bash the big ones. I mean, we like that. That's what we like to keep doing.
After it was all over, the Elizabethan government actually produced an official list of all the ships which it thought had taken some share in the campaign, and it's 197, ranging from the biggest warship down to a tiny pinnace called the Pippin. But they certainly weren't all there at the same time, and many of these were very small ships, essentially in auxiliary roles. In terms of serious fighting ships, there were probably 30 or 40.
So the Armada set off in May 1588. It's going to be a long voyage. Briefly, Diane, what happened between then and when it reached the English Channel?
Well, they had a series of minor disasters. One kind of storm hit them so badly that Medina Sidonia actually wrote to Philip to say, are you sure God really blesses our voyage? Do you think we should call it off now? Because, you know, we've just been struck by a wind and probably God sent it. They finally made it to Ushant on the 29th of July, and that's quite slow going
to
from Spain. Ushant. Ushant is the last of France, the northwest tip of France. It's an island, belongs to Brittany, and it's also the gateway to the English Channel. So it was really a slog even just to get up from the Spanish ports as far as Ushant. And it also meant that every intelligencer in Europe knew they were coming. Everybody had seen them. They were finally sighted in the Channel on the 30th of July, and Drake had watchers all along the Channel. This is something that everybody will know about, the beacons. They lit the Lizard Beacon on the 30th of July, and the messenger, Julie, head off to Plymouth to tell Drake that the beacon had been lit. Drake was delighted because this was his plan coming beautifully into effect. It had been his risky strategy to put those relatively few English fighting ships at Plymouth rather than putting them in the narrow part of the channel adjacent to the Low Countries, which is what some campaigners had wanted him to do. His bet had been that the Spanish would come along the coast, that they would arrive in the west first, and that he, Drake, could therefore get the weather gauge, could kind of trap them almost. So this he duly did. They then had to welter their way out of Plymouth Harbour on an ebb tide, which is not too easy, and that's why he had time to finish that famous game of bowls, unless course, that's a complete myth, but it's why he would have had time. He would have had ages to finish a game of bowls while they sort of mucked about. They manoeuvred and they got the weather gauge. They got to windward of the Spanish fleet. And that placed them absolutely ideally just where you want to be in a naval battle, behind the enemy. And this they duly did. They had a totally different set of tactics to the Spanish, and the Spanish were actually horrified. We have records to say this, at what the English did. The English formed into a long line, broadside on to the Spanish, which Spanish tactics said you must never do. You must absolutely be face on to the enemy, because the Spanish way was to try to close with a ship, board it, and thus take it. The English way was to use this terrific ordnance that they had on the race ships, this terrific cannon fire, to destroy the enemy ships.
Nicholas, Diana raised the idea of Drake moving some of the fleet down to Plymouth. And who was in charge on the British side? Who was doing the planning? And so that suggests that there's a division in the planning. Can you and the beacon obviously suggests that, and so on. Can you just give us a bit more idea of how we got sorted out for it?
Well, ultimately, the Queen and her council are in charge, and they are taking the major strategic decisions, certainly on the disposition of the fleet. The actual commander-in-chief of the fleet is the Lord Admiral of England, Lord Howard of Effingham. And Drake is his second in command, one of a number of experienced seamen who advise him. They don't all agree, and Howard, though he's a less experienced seaman than the rest of them, is there, amongst other things, to be the man who takes the ultimate decision and listens to the advice. By this point, he'd been converted to Drake's argument that since the prevailing winds blow up the channel from the southwest, in order to command the situation, the English needed to be down at the mouth of the channel. Otherwise, there was a grave risk that the Spaniards might land in the West Country, which they had been known to have been thinking of doing in the past.
So, Mia Rodriguez Salgado, let's just take something that Nicholas said a bit further. The key people on each side, we've heard about Medina Sidonia. He wasn't the first choice, was he? And then we've heard about Lord Howard and Sir Francis Drake. Can we just elaborate on these?
Yes, the original commander for the fleet was the Marquis of Santa Cruz, but he had died in February of 1587.
He'd won the Battle of Lepanto, hadn't he?
He'd taken part, but he was an extremely experienced seaman and ideal commander for this type of force, and he had also fought in the Azores and combined an amphibious operation. However, once he died, he was very rapidly replaced by the Duke of Medina Sidonia, who was also highly experienced. He had been putting together the defensive squadrons for the Indies. He was a very high-ranking aristocrat, and those were the two crucial criteria that you needed for somebody to command that fleet. So this myth that he got seasick and that he was hopeless and he knew nothing about the sea is just that, a myth. He was a deal commander because of his status, because of his capacity to organise a navy and his capacity to enforce obedience.
How strong was Howard's command? Nicholas Rogers mentioned that they had these persons under him, like most eminently Drake, and then he took their advice in some ways, but had the final say. Do we know anything more about the dynamics of those relationships?
Well, the dynamics are actually quite similar. What you have at the head of both the naval forces and the military forces are nobles, high-ranking nobles. And what you have below them are either sort of experts or lower members of the lower nobility who have much more practical, technical exercise. Now, both Howard of Effingham and Medina Sidonia depend on these naval experts and these military experts to advise them. But they take the decision, and they take the rap if they get the wrong decision, and they're all used to this. Now, what we have in the two navies, though, is a different level of, if you like, authority and obedience. In the case of the Spanish fleet, those below Medina Sidonia obeyed his orders. Mind you, he had a habit of hanging anybody who didn't, so that had a very sort of...
A salty effect.
it had the right effect, let's put it that way. So there was never an issue of disobedience. The lower level commanders of the fleet obeyed orders and kept to them. In the case of the English fleet, this wasn't the case. Drake and some of the others were used to acting on their own, and there is this famous incident quite early on in the crisis, if we can call it that, where two Spanish ships had been damaged, one of them got left behind, and Drake simply abandons the English fleet and goes back to take the prize. Now, that does not happen at all in the Spanish fleet. But in many ways, there are sort of similarities between them.
When did first contact take place then, Diane?
First contact took place on the 30th of July, and then the subsequent 2 days. That was when Drake's fleet encountered the Armada for the first time. I'm keen to come back to defend Drake against the idea that he was nothing but a pirate.
The privateer, man, we call him a privateer.
Well, yeah, but I think we were calling him a pirate when he took the Rosario, and I completely understand that. But what we also have to understand is that on the English ships, the captain was in sole command of everybody on board that ship, which wasn't straightforwardly the case on the Armada ships. And the captains, Drake had this kind of rule of leadership, which he picked up from classical lit, amazingly, that the captain should take a hand with the ropes in a crisis and haul on a sheet if necessary. And we've actually got a letter from one commander on an English Navy ship saying, "I can't write this letter, I have to get a scribe to do it because I hurt my hand hauling on a rope. This is a nobleman." My bet is that Medina Sidonia wasn't hauling on too many sheets.
No, but nor was Howard of Effingham.
No, that's certainly true.
You've got to make a difference. Yeah. Whereas the equivalents of Drake's, people like Bertendona or Don Hugo de Moncada, who dies with an arquebus shot through the head, are doing exactly that. A good military commander or naval commander will get down and get his hands dirty when there is a crisis, but not the commander-in-chief. Yeah, and I think, you have to compare like with like.
That's certainly fair. I never did hear of Howard of Effingham hauling on any sheets.
Can I turn to Nicholas Roger now? In the early days of August, the crucial event of the Armada took place, the Battle of Gravelines. Can you tell us how that battle unfolded and what significance it had, Nicholas Roger?
Well, we've jumped, as it were, over a number of days of very slow progress as the Armada works its way up the channel, with the English constantly skirmishing and firing at them, avoiding coming to close quarters and firing their famous heavy guns. What the English hoped and what the Spaniards feared was that this very heavy armament, no Spanish ship had anything like that kind of armament, was going to knock the Spanish ships to pieces. But actually it didn't happen. There was a good deal of damage, but nothing fatal. And the Spanish fleet arrives in due course at the Narrows and anchors off Calais, which is a French port, but with a governor friendly to the Spanish interests. They're only 30 miles or so away from where Palmer's army is known to be. The crisis of the campaign has arrived. Everybody's aware of this. The Spaniards are asking the question, where is the Duke of Parma and his troops? Why are they not lining the beach at this moment? The English are asking precisely the same question. Where is the Duke of Parma and his troops? He can't be far away. For the English, the critical thing is that the Spanish fleet cannot be allowed to lie in Calais roads a moment longer while Parma's troops presumably are marching rapidly towards it. No, not that rapidly, actually, but both sides thought they were, and there was every reason to think that they were. So the English have to get the Spaniards out of Calais roads as fast as possible, and since the English themselves are anchored only a mile or two away to windward, there is an obvious way of doing it, namely fire ships. And this is what they do. The Spaniards had anticipated it.
Can you just tell listeners who are not familiar with fire ships how these things operated?
Simply, you get an expendable small ship. In fact, the English basically grabbed any small ships they could find, stuffed them full of everything that will burn. Ships are full of things that will burn anyway, so it's not terribly difficult. You get some bold volunteers who will volunteer to sail the ships towards the enemy fleet, and when they get fairly close, light the blue touch paper and pile into a boat and pull like hell to get away. And since ships, wooden ships, were very, very inflammable and, of course, full of powder as well as everything else. This is a dangerous, very dangerous weapon. It's liable to terrify people and cause panic. It didn't, I think, cause panic in the Spanish fleet. They were prepared for it. It was the obvious means of attack. They had orders what to do. They actually managed to get hold of these fireships and tow them away. But what they did have to do was to cut their cables, which means, of course, losing precious anchors, and clear away to sea. And they never got back to their anchorage. And the English were able, the following morning, to mount a major attack, in which, I think because they were desperate, they came to much closer range than they had risked before. Close enough for people actually to shout to one another from one ship to another. So we're probably talking about a fighting range down to 50 yards or less. And at that range, the English heavy guns began to cause really serious damage.
Mayor Rodriguez Salgado, is this the turning point? Do the Spanish fleet then turn north and abandon Mission A and start Mission B, which is to get back? And the way that they sought to get back was to go right round the British Isles, past the north of Scotland, down past Ireland, and blah, blah, blah. Is this the point where that happened?
It is for the reasons that Nicholas Rogers has explained, that they lose their anchorage. Now, they try to get back to it, but they can't. The winds are against them. And they hold on as much as they can simply because they believe the army is ready. And it was almost ready. I mean, people are very critical of this strategy, but it almost worked. I mean, they were hours from making it work. Yeah. So, you know, it is risky, certainly, but it isn't that outrageous. So what they do is they try to hang on there as long as they can. And then the wind changes and starts pushing the armada towards the sandbanks of the Low Countries. And for a time, the Spanish fleet believes it's going to be destroyed, not by the English, but just they're going to run aground,
as
some
weather.
Of them do, by the weather.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, miraculously, as far as they're concerned, the wind changes and gives them this prospect of actually going northwards. And on the 12th of August, Medina Sidonia gives the order to go northwards. But he tells everybody, go slow. If the wind changes, we'll turn back. And in fact, the English are not at all sure that the armada will not come back to the channel. However, the weather doesn't change, and they decide that what they're going to do is go round about Britain, as you mentioned, in order to get back to Spain.
And it's there very briefly at this, after Gravelines, Dan, that Queen Elizabeth gives her famous Tilbury speech. Not
yes,
before
after
the whole
the crucial battle, she gives this
well
speech
that in,
that's
yeah.
so historical.
Yeah.
In the wrong place. I mean, why they assembled what troops they could muster at Tilbury when the Spanish plan was always probably to go to Kent in the kind of correct historical manner is a bit of a mystery. And anyway, the troops that they'd assembled at Tilbury were an extremely ramshackle group. There was one group of men who had bows and arrows but hadn't been trained to use them, for example. But yes, that's where she does the speech, and I'm sure it was very motivational. But it does illustrate what actually Mia just said, that they didn't see the threat as over. They didn't kind of feel that the events on the Flanders banks had settled things, that they felt that there was still a danger, and they felt, therefore, that the speech was still worth making, that they still had to rally the infantry troops that they'd managed to muster.
Yes, so we're still in flux, Nicholas Roger. The Spanish fleet, which is still powerful and feared, hasn't by no means been defeated at this stage. It has been battered, and the English are snapping around and coming close and getting rather desperate and hammering away. But it's still a big mass of ships, well manned in terms of seamanship and so on, but headed north, trying to go with the weather.
Yes, the English, at this point, and the English had a whole series of major fears, but nobody thought they'd won a great battle, or indeed that the issue was actually decided. The English had virtually run out of ammunition. They had been firing at a faster rate than anybody had ever done before, or that they themselves had expected to do, and they were virtually bluffing at this point, because many of the ships had no powder and shot left at all. And the natural expectation was that Philip II had prepared a port somewhere in the North Sea. There were a number of available potential allies. Hamburg was a possibility. Scotland was a possibility. There seemed to be some obvious it would have been obvious, they thought, for the Armada to have a base prepared where it could take refuge, repair damage and return when the wind served to renew the campaign. And that was what the English were really frightened of.
I haven't been looking at the clock properly. We're nearly up. Can you just cut to the significance of this, Mia? What significance did this have? They went round Scotland. They were battered by awful weather round Isle. They ran out of food. They ran out of water when they got on the shore. They were butchered and so on and so forth. But quite a considerable number got back to Spain, about three quarters. But what was the significance to Spain of this episode?
In the short term, of course, they were devastated, but three quarters of the fleet, as you say, returned. The loss of men, of experienced soldiers and sailors, was actually much more serious than the loss of ships. They can be replaced far more easily. But Philip II simply got on with it. He immediately started repairing them and thought in terms of sending another fleet the following year. In fact, that fleet isn't ready at the time when the English do a counter armada and try to invade Spain the following year. And that expedition was a complete failure. And by the end of 1589, both Philip II and Elizabeth have, in fact, if not entirely disengaged, decided to refocus and get involved in the French Civil War. So they don't really fight each other for a number of years.
And what effect did this have on England when it was clear that when the sea settled, as it were?
I think it's fair to say that if Philip had hoped to improve the situation of English Catholics, then nothing could have been more disastrous. Because the English really didn't believe they'd won a great and final victory even in the 1590s. They were expecting Philip to re-engage with them. And they were terrified of a fifth column of Catholics within their midst. And the result was a really crushing persecution campaign with torture and, you know, inquisitorial tactics for people who had done nothing much worse than import a few forbidden books.
Finally, Nicholas, what effect did it... Did it have a big effect on English morale and sense of itself?
I think it did, though in the long term, rather than immediately, but in the long term, it is the key event in a long process of creating an English national myth which identifies the sea and war at sea as the way in which the English nation in arms is at sea and not on land.
Thank you very much indeed, Diane Perkis, Mia Rodriguez-Salgado and Nicholas Roger. And next week, Sturm und Drang, Germany in the 1770s. Thank you very much for listening.
If you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast, why not try others, such as Thinking Aloud, where Laurie Taylor discusses the latest social science research. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.